Welcome to the Hospitality Podcast.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Come on, man.
I just need a...
This is the lamb
sauce. Where's the lamb sauce?
Presented by Arthur Gomez.
God damn, I just spent $8,000 on f***ing wine.
And Quentin Wind.
What are you?
An idiot sandwich.
So pour yourself a glass, because we're diving into the world of restaurants, kitchen, and bar. The Hospitality Podcast.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, hello.
Welcome to Breaking the Cork. Today, a new episode, as always, with a special guest. We have with us today Alexandra Price. She's the head of wine at Crispin Group. Just before starting the podcast, we just wanted to say a big thank you to our sponsor of today's podcast. It's Coravin.
Thank you very much, Coravin. Thank you for sponsoring and supporting the channel. Arthur, you know a lot about Coravin. Obviously, you have one.
Yeah.
So do you want to explain a little bit?
Of course. Well, I use it a lot at home, but also at work. Mm-hmm. So basically, Coravin, it's a wine preservation system, meaning that, let's say, for example, you want to open a bottle of wine, but you're not sure you're going to have the full bottle. Mm-hmm. You just want one or two glasses.
Half a glass. Yeah.
Exactly. You can use a Coravin device. So basically, there are three different devices. The first one is the... I would say like the professional one is the timeless. So meaning you don't have to open or pull out the cork of the bottle.
Yeah.
You just have to use the Coravin with like a
needle.
A very small needle through the cork. And so you can preserve your wine for like, I would say to be fair, many years.
Yeah.
So very safe. The other one they have, it's more like an everyday tool, with like the Coravin Pivot, where you have to open the bottle this time. Where you're putting like a device
on
the
top.
Bottle. Exactly. And so it's going to preserve your wine for up to 4 weeks. The last one is the Coravin Sparkling. It's a device who perfectly preserves the flavors and the effervescence, the bubbles of champagne and sparkling, up to 4 weeks as well.
So it's better than putting a spoon in for the next day.
way better. And at least your show is going to work.
Ah, there you go.
And so the special surprise we have for you today, guys, it's a 20% discount on the Coravin Sparkling. So very easy to use. Just put the code BREAKINGTHECORK20 you're doing your purchase, and you will have 20% off discount.
And that's for trade and all personal use as well,
Trade and public, exactly.
Thank you very much, Coravin, for this support. And again, guys, if you want to have that discount, check the link or otherwise just put BREAKINGTHECORK20 in the discount code in the checkout.
And now back to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Alex, for coming to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
With pleasure. Just before we start, we're going to tell the audience what we're drinking. And
because that's the thing. We always open a bottle when we start the podcast, and we never talk about the wine.
Yeah,
so we're like, today we have a good wine with us, a good guest. We have to talk about the wine.
So do you want to have do the intro on the wine?
But basically, it's a Cathy Ribaud. So, Alex, you're having this wine on your list?
I don't list it, but I tasted it last year and I loved it. It's groovy, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's basically a producer from Mallorca, if I'm right.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, and but the last time I tried actually was at your wine bar, Bermondsey Corner, on Bermondsey Street.
We loved it. I think we had two bottles, actually.
We had two bottles, actually, two different.
But how would you describe it, actually?
It's got a nice little smokiness to it.
Yep.
So much pressure.
don't worry. No pressure on the butt.
Just like at work. It's
like crunchy cranberry character.
It does, it's quite juicy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But it's got that nice, almost savory, smoky bacon type character in the finish, I think. Is it Lista Negra?
No, I think it's... let me double check. I don't want to say something. Excursac.
Oh.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, it says it on the label.
So actually, I tried the sparkling a few weeks ago at the Resto Sune.
Okay.
With the first restaurant of Oni Spencer.
Yes, so
amazing.
Good.
Yeah. The food there was amazing.
Okay.
The wine selection great. The service top notch.
Yeah.
I would recommend 100%.
It's so fun as well, because you just like go and sit outside and like have a glass of wine and you like bump into like so many friends you know from the industry, and it's just like quite a nice like hub.
Yeah.
And obviously Honey's there like absolutely killing it with Charlie and
Are you close to Honey? Oh yeah, okay, cool.
And we've got a good strong little female wine chat.
That's
which
good.
Is nice.
That's nice. Maybe Honey, we're gonna have you on the podcast one day.
Sure, she's great.
Yeah,
she's really cool. And her book that's just come out as well, Wine, No Drama.
I like the title.
Good opportunity.
Anyways, the focus is a bit on you now. It'll be nice to give our audience a little bit of a definition of what you do, head of wine. What is actually a head of wine?
So yeah, head of wine for four restaurants of the Ham Restaurant Group. So that was the original one, which was Crispin, that we opened in 2018. Yep. So then Bar Crispin, which is when the point I joined in 2021, just after COVID, opened that as general manager. But then a year later became head of wine when we started plans on opening the third site, which was Bistro Freddy, which we were just talking about. And then our recently opened Crispin at Rue de Voltaire. But a head of wine, so basically what it entails is curating the list for each site, managing the wine programs for each restaurant, and tailoring like the training to each sort of site and see what things work. And yeah, doing lots of trainings, briefings, managing the financials of it, like making sure the GBs and everything are in line with the company goals, generally going to tastings, which is one of the best parts.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Yeah.
And yeah, just writing the chance to write a wine list for each venue and create such a like personal sort of character, like a list that reflects like the character of that place is my favorite thing to do. So
and the food as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Are you doing the training for all the sommelier as well?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. We don't necessarily have sommelier teams in each restaurant. We have different people who either have more interest in wine.
Okay, good.
Nurture them.
Nice.
But it's good at just doing lots of trainings at the moment. We've got a few new team members going back to the basics on like fermentation and how sparkling wine is made and everything.
Yeah. We're alongside tasting as well.
Oh, of course. Well, actually, we did one yesterday on sparkling wine. I didn't actually open anything, so I feel a bit bad now. But
that's good.
It was practical. We had to learn the facts first. But yeah, there's lots of tastings.
So you're doing the training, the purchasing, the cost. Are you still on the floor sometimes? Are you working on the floor?
Yeah, I'm probably a lot less than I used to. I think I noticed the difference having the fourth site, that it really just suddenly stretches your time and you're suddenly then trying to like manage and juggle everything in one go, taking me off the floor a bit. I've always found it like the busy periods, like Christmas time, it's nice to shut my laptop, stop looking at spreadsheets and go on the floor and actually sell the wine. So it goes in like peaks and ebbs and flows.
Do you miss it to be off on the floor?
I do, yeah. I'm definitely getting more tired, which is, I feel it's a bit pathetic to say. I'm only 33, but you definitely feel it the next morning. But that getting that like rush and that buzz when you're talking to customers who either weren't so sure about a wine and they taste something and then they suddenly love it, or like, you're just talking to someone who knows loads and you can have a really great conversation going. And also just like being with the team and like opening a bottle for the team and then like seeing their reactions and seeing them interact with it and seeing the people who previously like maybe like start the job and say like, oh, I hate wine, or I don't like this and I don't like that, and then to like see them change and grow and evolve and like actually start to sort of care what's in their glass.
So like more the exchange you can have with the customers and the feedbacks. And yeah, that's
it's funny because there's
really
a lot of staff that at first they don't like wine and they grow with it, but only if you do it properly. When you explain to the staff how wine is made, you know, the whole philosophy behind it, and make them understand how to taste wine and how to appreciate it. It's funny because you really get their, their attention.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I started working wine like 11 years ago. I mean, it was, especially the job I started at, it was quite like a boys' club, and I was like the only girl working in the office, and I really had to make sure, fight for my place there and go to all the tastings, and like it was terrifying, like turning up to these big sort of old school like tastings where everyone's wearing red trousers and it's just quite like a male dominated space, and I'm there like turning up aged, was like 21 or something, 22, and looking pretty young, and I'm obviously quite small, so like people are like, who are you even allowed to drink?
Do you think the wine industry now in 2024 is a bit old school still?
No, definitely not. I think it's changed a hell of a lot. It's a funny one though, because I think I'm in such a different space in the industry than I was when I first joined. Like I started my career working at Annabelle's for the Burley Clubs and the wider Caprice Holdings. So it definitely had that more traditional, obviously old school background to it. And so like naturally the people we were working with were that sort of old brigade of the wine trade. But what was quite cool is that I met some of my closest friends now at that sort of time as well. And we've, over the past like 10 years, grown together. And to see the positions where we were then to where we are now and what we're experiencing and the young crowd that's coming in as well is really cool. And so I think it's definitely moved in the right direction for sure.
I think we're going a bit more into the natural, sustainable wine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Being more focused on like the producer.
There's less about, I don't know how to say that, but about just making wine and drinking wine.
Especially the younger generation. I think I'm part of it. We prefer to drink less, but better. Mm-hmm. But then before it was more binge drinking a lot, but I don't really care about.
Yeah. There has been a study that came out saying that the younger generation are drinking less, and mainly due because now there's this presence of you need to be fit. With social media, there's a lot of being fit and all these advices on how to stay in a better form of yourself. So that obviously changed a lot. But even in Russia, that was used to be a country that used to drink a lot, especially vodka. Mm-hmm. The younger generation completely against it. And I'm not generalizing, obviously there are still some, but there's a big change in terms of the young not drinking as much as they used to as well. And
but you can tell it with all the soft drink or non-alcoholic options that have flooded the market, I think, especially in the past 2 years. There's something incredible options, and the price is finally starting to come down and be a bit more affordable. And because I think you think a couple of years ago, that some of the only options were Seedlip, but however much a bottle, and it would be customer perception of buying a Seedlip and tonic would still be almost the same as buying gin and tonic. And and it's changing the mindset now, and I think it's really cool. I went to a really fab tasting earlier this year, I think it was, at Pricity, and it was for Oddbird, which is a non-alcoholic, non-alcoholic sort of wine option, but they make the actual sort of alcoholic versions as well. So really great producers making them. My favorite one was an Alsatian wine from a domain called Domaine Achille.
Oh, I know that one. Yeah.
And so they did a de-alcoholized version, and it was delicious, and you could really just get the sense of terroir and the grapes. And I think that's so missing from a lot of sort of non-alcoholic options.
It took a while for beer to be a non-alcoholic, and it's now booming completely. Yeah. They're smashing the records of selling non-alcoholic wine, especially in January.
Massively. But it's so funny how things change so quickly. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of requests for non-alcoholic or low alcohol?
It varies in different sites. I think certain sites have more requests. So at Crispin, there's we have a really great selection of non-alcoholic cocktails, and Gotham, who designs all the cocktails there, has done a great job at that, and they're super enjoyable options. So they sell really well. Bistro Freddy, not really. The Martinis and the Negronis, and Bar Crispin, so occasionally.
At Wine, you are in charge for the wine and beverage, or you also in charge maybe of the spirits a bit for the bar?
Do a bit of the spirits as well, and there's beers as well. We recently, when we opened Bistro Freddy, we installed Guinness and Stella Unfiltered, which is really delicious. I don't know if you've had that before. Although I had a customer tell me it's not good for you the other day, and I was like, oh, whatever. And then Guinness has had such a moment over the past, I guess, year and a half, especially with the Devonshire and stuff.
Yeah. You've been to Devonshire?
Yes, a few times. It's very good.
Yeah. I tried last time, impossible to get a table.
Try walking in.
Walking in?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I've never booked. I've gone 3 times, but only walking in. There is hope.
There's so much people. And I discovered, to be fair, on Top Draw.
Oh, yeah.
Now, every time I'm passing by, it's packed of people.
The amount of Guinness they go through is unbelievable.
Only Guinness. They're all drinking Guinness. Yeah.
Why only Guinness? Why do people go for that? I mean,
they know how to pour a really good pint of Guinness.
Do you really feel the difference between pours?
I think you can tell the difference between a bad Guinness and a good Guinness. But I don't want to say on a podcast that I can tell the difference, just in case someone decides to call me out. But I mean, I can appreciate a well poured Guinness.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It is tasty. But wowee, it's had a resurgence.
I mean, Guinness, I've never been a big fan of Guinness myself.
I love Guinness. A good Guinness.
Have you seen Shit London Guinness Instagram page, submitting bad photos? And there are some pretty bad ones.
You're already.
So when we installed it at Crispin at Rue de Voltaire, I spent a good 10 minutes pouring some pints with the team. So I was like, we do not want to. And we only pour in half pints as well. So we have to get that.
Wow.
It makes it a little harder.
Yeah, of course. You said about 12 years ago. Yeah. So you went to your first wine fair. What made you go into wine then? At what age? How did it come about to start in wine?
So I did history of art at university. Was kind of probably always hoping to go down the sort of auction house route, the Sotheby's, Christie's. But I did Corkscrew Society at school, which probably sounds a bit pretentious, but it was amazing. It was it really opened my eyes to that whole world. And I actually found some of my notes when I went back to my parents' house a couple months ago, and I was reading back. I was like, oh my God, how, wow, I actually knew what I was talking about then. But I didn't then think about that as a career until I met someone at a friend's party and they were like, do you know, you can do exams in wine at the WSETs. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. That's like really cool. Mm. And so like after a couple of months of trying to get into the art world, I was like, do you know, actually wine is what I want to do. And I very luckily got a job working as a sales administrator in the Annabelle's wine cellar. In the Burley Cellars, which I was the first girl to ever work there.
So what is a sales administrator for a restaurant or like a group?
So that was quite a funny title, actually. It didn't really make much sense. I think the guy who had my position beforehand was very much just there for data entry. Okay. He didn't care about wine. He didn't join in any of the tastings, which thinking back is pretty wild because the actual office itself was like in the cellar. So we spent a good 2 years down there until they moved us up. My boss was there for 26 years. Oh, he did it. He had to buy some seasonal depression lamps. So
seriously,
that's kind of crazy.
It was kind of crazy. I mean, like the working conditions.
Big beard.
Coming up.
But they would forget about us. And
they locked me up 26 years ago.
Things have changed a bit. But it was incredible. Like, I still like get goosebumps when I think about the first time of walking in that cellar. It was like just not, obviously not as long as this building, but it was it was long, and I went under the building, under the Muse houses and Hayes Muse and Mayfair, and so crazy.
How's the cellar of Annabelle?
They changed it up, and with the new club opening, but like the old Annabelle's, which had the very old school cellar.
Yeah. With a nice wine inside.
Amazing wines.
Yeah, I can
insane.
Imagine.
Like the Romney Conti that they had was just like, I still can't believe this. I will never ever forget this. They had a bottle of Romney Conti 82 on the inventory list at £62.
£62?
I know. Like, can I buy this? And obviously he was like, no. Obviously you can't.
£62?
And obviously it was like retailing at the time, and even more now.
At least.
Insane.
That's like better than Bitcoin, right?
Oh, it's way better. Yeah. But I think the essence in terms of investment, it's like Domaine des Tours, Château des Tours, Château Reyes.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
But it was a magical place. We also did the buying for the wider Caprice Holdings groups. So the Burley Clubs and then Scott's, the Jay Shiki's, the Ivy, all those kind of restaurants. And there was a very small team of us, so we all got involved, which was amazing. And I think from the moment I joined, I was like, I'm here to learn. I want to soak in as much as possible. I didn't have any formal training at this point, and I did my exams along the way, which was, it was wild, actually, the first year. The guys from Annabelle's would like come down into the cellar and we'd see them and we'd talk, but I didn't actually get onto the floor until I was 27. I've kind of done a bit backwards, and I'm cringe when I say this now, but I remember when I was younger, I was, oh, I'd never be a sommelier. Like, why would I want to do that? And obviously that is like what I love doing now. Yeah, yeah. And it's such a big part of my life. And I actually can't believe I'm saying that out loud. But at the time I was like, no, like hospitality. Yeah. And I think there was still that sort of stigma of like working in hospitality and on the floor. And obviously being such a different schedule to my friends. And it was like unthinkable. And then it was only until I went to a company called Beaverbrook, a hotel members club in Surrey, that I started working in one of their restaurants there. Accident. I didn't realize that was the job I was going to be doing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you applied for a job and you thought it was like a back office job?
I was kind of told a little bit. Yeah, I was told one thing and it was something else. But that's by the by, because I realized I loved it and was quite good at it. And my boyfriend there as well, he's a chef. And I think that kind of changed my perspective on hospitality. And I was like, wow, this is fucking cool.
How many years have you done in Annabelle's in the cellar then?
So I was there for 4 years, two of which were actually in the cellar. Mm. And then we moved to an office when they were like, this is not okay.
We need to give good conditions for our staff. Like,
they're a bit weird. Yeah. I mean, we did have Fine Wine Friday every Friday, which was...
Oh, it's cool.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Nice. Special times. But then from there, I moved to Domaine Direct. Still office-based, obviously. They were a Burgundy specialist. And then it was only from then, which is when I realized like I missed that connection. Like whilst I wasn't on the floor at Annabelle's, there was always that connection with going down into the kitchen and talking to the chefs and having that lovely rapport with customers as well, because we would speak to the members and we would suggest wines at Christmas. And it was just that being in that whole sort of environment was really exciting. And that's what sort of probably drew me to the position at Beaverbrook. Fully straight on the restaurant floor, which was a bit of a shock.
And what was your job at Beaverbrook, directly?
I was assistant manager and sommelier and like wine manager of the estate. It was good, and I learned a lot. So that was, and it set me up for the job that I'm doing now. And obviously Bar Crispin was very floor focused. Like I wrote the wine list as well as managing the bar as well.
For me, obviously loving wine is one thing. What are your strong points to be in that position that you are? Because for me, it's more obviously having the taste of wine, but especially for it's remembering and having that passion for it. And I find it really hard to remember because I've got a really bad memory. And sometimes I do remember names, but especially in sports, for some reason, sports seems to be, you know, it's, I remember names so easily. I don't know why. With wine, my God, it's it doesn't work.
Because you're probably watching sports quite regularly.
No.
Oh, okay, fine. I was going to say repetition.
Yeah, I guess so. But I drink more wine than I actually watch any sports.
Okay, so that's my theory debunked.
Maybe you drink too much wine.
Maybe that's the end. I can't remember.
Maybe that's right. That's the main focus.
I didn't think of that.
I think tasting, like constantly tasting, going to tastings, being open to learning and to talking to people and meeting winemakers. Yeah. And I've been very fortunate in the positions that I've jobs I've been in that I have been exposed to lots of great importers and winemakers that come in to visit us or trips that I've been on. And like those moments are so valuable. And I think if you're like open to learning and you're keen to dive into it, then I think that's where you build up on it. And
of course.
And yeah, taste.
I don't know about you, Alex, but I had like some breaks. Sometimes we like 2-3 months where I'm not really focused into wine, or I'm not learning, I'm not studying.
And you
feel like you're losing so much, like you forget completely about like
totally
classic stuff. Like, I don't know.
That's my life.
It's apart
from sports, apparently.
Like I had that last year for a couple of months. I was like, I felt a bit disconnected from the industry, and I think I'd been so busy with the opening of the restaurant that I'd stopped learning and stopped going to tastings and stopped like communicating with suppliers and importers and reading and just taking time out to further like my knowledge. And I made a promise to myself at the end of last year that I would like start saying yes to everything again, go to those tastings, like get up early and go. And it's made such a difference. And like you feel like your love for it just, I think then it's easier to pass that on. It's so infectious, isn't it, when like you talk about wine and everyone's like, oh, we could get really excited. And I think it's important to draw yourself back to remembering why you love.
Oh, cool. You did the WCT?
I did, yes. I did pretty much all the diploma. I haven't actually finished it.
Is that?
We'll cut that.
We'll cut that one.
I did every single exam. I did it. So I did it in 2015, so a long time ago. Wow. Yeah. And I passed all of them pretty quickly. But the theory for that Light Wines of the World exam, for me. I did it twice.
Okay.
And I failed. I passed the tasting straight away.
Okay, nice.
The important part.
Which is the most important. Yeah. What do you think about the WCT in general?
I always say to people, I think if you're doing it, I think you'll get the most out of level 3. I think I had a funny relationship with level 4. It's such a big undertaking. And I think if you're ready for it, then it can be amazing. But I think those, if you're in the wine trade, it can be a bit hard to do alongside your job. I think I remember going to the classes, and the people who were absorbing the most and learning what they were teaching you were people who didn't work in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I think it's quite a rigid way of learning. There'd be many occasions where I'd say something from what I'd either experienced at work or from what I'd learned from the people who'd like come to visit. And I'd get shut down and be like, that's not true, or that's not the case. And just because it didn't really fit into the sort of curriculum. So in that sense, I was a bit like, this is, I don't know, it's quite contradictory. No. But it's an amazing learning board. Mm. Level 3 gives you that real great base knowledge to like to then go into your own learning. Mm. Because diploma is basically like a university degree, isn't it? You spend most of the time teaching yourself because, I mean, you have a lesson and then you don't do the exam until 10 months later.
Yeah. It's very long as well. It's a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah.
And then it takes 10 million years to get your results back.
Yeah.
But, and I also did it when spirits were still on the board.
Oh, the spirits.
That makes me feel quite old when I talk about this. They got rid of it, and that was bloody pain in the neck as well.
Because we have the spirits, we have the sake, the wine, and I think we have the beer.
Oh, they have a beer one now.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure.
I would actually like to see the sake one, I think.
Oh, yeah?
The sake one?
I think that'd be quite interesting.
You need to go try the sake bar over there.
Oh, really?
There's one under one of the arches, yeah. Apparently, okay. It's really good.
That's good to know.
What do you think about the sake?
I love it. I find it super interesting. I think there's loads of similarities with wine, and I think it's easy to think of sake as just like something that you drink really hot, and it's just sort of, it's high in alcohol, but it's not necessarily, not all of them are super high in alcohol, but it's so nuanced. And I think when you start realizing that and start tasting so many different styles, it's like fascinating. And it's really cool. So I'd like to learn more about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of actually of a bar now in London will include a large selection of sake.
Yeah.
Would you include, but for example, any sake to pair with
100%. I just think from my perspective, I'd rather learn a bit more about it and so maybe study it a bit more, put focus on that before introducing it to a wineness of mine, because I'd want it to be the most authentic thing it can be from my perspective.
Is your love for drinks as big as for food?
I think it goes hand in hand quite nicely.
Yeah.
I think you've got to keep eating if you want to keep drinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so many, I think it happens on both sides, both some certain foods or some wines really come alive when you pair them with food. And I think that's really special. And obviously there's wines for drinking just on their own, but there's also, it's a magical world sometimes with pairing.
Any outstanding food and wine pairing you have at Crispin Group? Can be at Bistro Freddy or Crispin Voltaire, the last one.
We did last year, maybe it was actually the year before, an event with John Javier from the tent at the end of the universe. And he brought his master Chinese concept to Bar Crispin, and he cooked with Fabian, our head chef there. And there was this one particular dish. And I did the wine pairing for that. Served all in magnum format, which was just fun in itself. But there was this one particular dish that John did, which was cheese with durian and rice. And it was like a fast food. Like
durian, seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's such a divisive food item. And I paired it with this really delicious Arinto from this producer called Enciadas de Baez. I think I probably murdered that pronunciation. And it was slightly oaked, and it really, because Arinto from just outside of Portugal, so the grape, it has a lovely like saltiness to it, but it also gone through some oak aging, and it was such an interesting pairing with the funky durian flavors and the cheese and the rice, and it was delicious. It was really cool.
The smell wasn't there for the durian?
It was a bit, but it was like they also blow-torched it as well, so that kind of helped.
Durian is the fruit.
Big fruit that smells
very bad.
That was a while ago, so I hope I've done that dish description justice.
Yeah.
I don't want John knocking on my door.
It's actually very tricky to find a good wine pairing with that fruit, the durian.
I wouldn't know where to start with that, to be honest.
I will be so lost. I'll be like, okay, let's do a whiskey.
Red wine with Coke.
Yeah.
Spanish style.
And have you tried that Tom Hanks champagne and Coca-Cola?
No.
I actually haven't either, but apparently it's delicious.
Really?
I
heard about it. So what's the recipe? Just putting like some Coke?
It's just Coca-Cola and champagne.
Why?
I haven't tried it yet. Waste champagne. But
do you know the dosage?
Not sure.
I'm sure whatever the dosage is.
You're still going to taste the Coke, but I guess Black Velvet works. It's not Coca-Cola.
I had recently, because I'm more in the coffee scene.
Yeah.
So, coffee and Coke?
No. Coffee and orange juice. I was like, yes. Yeah. And apparently it's amazing, but I haven't tried it yet. I need to try it and see what it is.
Coffee and orange juice.
Yeah, coffee and orange juice.
Oh, I don't know.
It's kind of a weird mix.
Hybrid.
But I mean, it's like the mimosa. Mimosa, I'm sure I felt it was like champagne,
orange juice.
And it's actually good.
And you drink that in the morning, even worse.
And you drink it in the morning.
Everything went wrong.
I just wanted to ask you if you have to choose one wine and or one estate.
Oh my gosh, I was not expecting this question.
I feel it changes a lot. Maybe the one of the moments. Be like, oh, I love this wine, or I love this producer.
Actually, I'll talk about this because it was super special. But I recently went to visit Reventos and Cansamoy in Penedès. Mm. And that was so incredible. It was like such an eye-opening trip because it was like seeing the different side of Carver. And like in a sort of industry which can be quite overpopulated with like mass produced stuff, like Pepe Reventos is making like this absolute like magical juice, and with their other sort of side project Cansamoya, which is literally at like the top of this sort of 800 meter hill mountain, and it was just like so beautiful and really rugged, and they just had so much care and love for what they were doing and what they were making. They just looked after like the hospitality themselves. It was just like, it was so special, like, and everything about it. And it was absolutely, it was like a daylight today. It was like pouring with rain, and we were all so excited to go to fly into Barcelona and it being superb sunshine, and it was like torrential rain, and but okay. Everyone there was like, oh my gosh, I'm just like so happy, like it's finally sort of given us some water.
Yeah.
And they provided us with like wellies and umbrellas. Yeah. And we walked around the vineyards, and it was really beautiful, and you could just smell that the rain was making everything smell so intense, and like you could smell more like the wild herbs. Yeah. It was just magical. And it was, the wines we drank from there were super interesting. We were trying like the still versions of the cave they produce from like Chirello from different parts of the vineyard. So there was like one with clay, the single varietal just from clay, single varietal just from limestone. And then there was another one which was limestone clay mix. And it was so interesting to try them side by side. That was beautiful. Yeah, nice. I think that's the answer.
It's one of a really good answer.
Yeah.
Sounds like it really marked you there.
Yeah, it was. And yeah, it was with a fab group. And yeah, it was special.
You know what? It reminds me when I used to work at Hedonism Wine, we used to...
You were at Hedonism, cool.
Yeah, at the wine bar, yeah. The waiters.
Ah, cool. Yeah. I haven't been there before, but
it's
sounds
cool.
Good. Yeah.
Really nice, like yeah. Romantic. But we used to have the Raventos Blanc de Blanc, or Blanco di Blanco, I think it is.
Yeah.
By the glass, it was amazing. It was one of the best cava I ever tried.
It's insane. It's insane. So beautiful.
And such a good value in terms of prices.
Yeah, I mean, oh my God, amazing. Massively.
Yeah.
I'll have to show you the photographs after this, because like, their cellar was like unbelievable. They go down deep, and it's obviously pretty cavernous, and they've got all the sort of big vats, but then they turn off all the lights, and then everyone's like, oh gosh, what's going on? And then suddenly they turn on this like strip lighting, and it goes all the way down this like row of barrels, and it's all like candlelit at the end, and it's like this really stunning sort of barrel room where they have a tasting table. It's like beautiful like light installation. Oh. Like the whole thing is gorgeous, and it like, I mean, it was probably a bit more, there was a bit more going on than a lot of other winemakers. Like you go and it's literally just like a little shed. But it was like, it was, I think, because they're such genuine people and such genuine winemakers that it just, I don't know, it worked. And it was just magical.
With your team at Crispin?
No, we were invited by Keeling and Andrew.
Ah, Keeling and Andrew.
So there was like me and a bunch of other Somms that went together. There was about five of us in total.
Are you doing often some trip like this with the suppliers?
Yeah. Going to Champagne. In a couple of weeks' time, which is going to be cool. Last year, we actually did, this was with Crispin, but we blended our own wine in Austria with them.
Oh.
That was a really cool moment, because I've never worked in a vineyard, and I would actually think I'd love to do that at one point in my life. But blending the wine was such a special thing to do. And also, it was quite funny, because I was like, oh, how do you blend the wine? Yeah. It feels like it should be really technical. And I put my head around the corner, and Christoph is there just literally staring at it. With a spoon.
Do me a favor, when you go to Champagne, bring a bottle of Coke.
I will, yes. Yeah. Yep, that's come full
circle.
You
can do a blending as well.
I will let you
see. Where are you going in Champagne?
Going to Louis Roederer.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we don't have any of the grand marks at the other sites at the moment, but for Studio Voltaire, the Christmas Year Old, I thought it would be quite a nice sort of like partnership, because obviously Studio Voltaire is an art gallery, and I know Louis Roederer they have a lot of drive to sustainability, and like most of their vineyards are now biodynamic. They have a great connection with the art world as well, so I thought that was quite nice.
That's nice.
Yeah. Like nice sort of connection.
Want to tell us a bit more about the, just to finish, the new Crispin at Studio Voltaire?
So it is about 50 cover restaurant. We've taken over the restaurant space in the art gallery Studio Voltaire just off Clapham Common. Beautiful gallery that's been going for about 30 years. And Jermaine Gallagher, who did the designs for Bistro Freddy and Bar Crispin, did the designs there as well. And it's absolutely gorgeous. I think it's actually my favorite space out of the four. And you can sit, working there is an absolute dream, because there is physically more space. Just walk around and you can see all the tables at once. And it's just really beautiful. Like in the day, it's like super light and airy. And then in the evening, all the candlesticks. And
amazing.
Opened in March.
Okay, nice.
But with that wine list, I did something a little bit different, which I think people are still a bit undecided with. But it's very small, but I focused on six different producers and tried to link in the connection of the winemaker as a as an artist, and so I did a little blurb about each one, talking about their terroir and their sort of like about them, and then did like a selection of their wines to like eventually change and do dinners and winemaker events and stuff like that.
Oh, that's good. When you're doing like a wine list, what is the kind of characteristic you're taking in consideration?
I think there's quite a few factors to look at. Sustainability runs throughout all of the wine lists that I do. I quite like to try and come up with something a bit unique and something that kind of like sets the wine list apart from the other places. I think I also take into consideration demographic and clientele that we're probably going to have. So making sure that there is obviously good accessible price points as well. We've done that at Crispin at Voltaire by introducing loads of wine on tap.
Mm. Oh, so you're having no wine on tap?
Yeah, we've got 7 wines on tap.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
It's working well?
Yeah, it's got super. It's nice. Really great. And then the bottle list is just like the producer focus. What I first do is I start off by working out where I want to go with the wine list, what kind of style. Like Bistro Freddy is all French. Bar Crispin is categorized into climate, so continental, maritime, Mediterranean. And from there, I then delve into, obviously, price point and different types of color and stuff like that. But I tend to focus on winemakers that are super sustainable. They don't have to be certified organic or biodynamic, but that's fine as well. But as long as they're working in that way and they're mindful of the land, my probably preferred choice of wine is probably the cleaner, more well-made like side of winemaking. So nothing too
funky.
Nothing too funky. Yeah. I mean, there are a few things for those people who ask for a funky wine. Yeah. But on the whole, I like to drink something quite clean. And that's why I quite like to sell. I mean, some of those wines that are on the funkier side, and if you put them by the glass, they can just die. And so much wasted. So that's
unless you have Cora.
That is true. We have just put Coravin in Bistro Freddy and Studio Voltaire as well.
Oh, nice. Is it working well?
It is working well. Bistro Freddy, I need to get it going. Coravin's amazing. And we just haven't ordered it until now.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
But it is good. It's a great way to drink great wine. I think when I was working at Annabelle's, like my first like big wine moment was a Chave Hermitage 1996. And we opened it. We'd had it by the Coravin. And that wine was just like insane. I think that was my wine moment ever.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but wow, it was amazing. And I definitely couldn't do this now, but I got very good at blind tasting Chave, which it sounds really ridiculous to say this now because I don't know if I could do it now because I just haven't drank it for a very long time. I think because I was working at Annabelle's, I was surrounded by that kind of wine quite a lot.
Like very fine wine.
And a few tasting groups I was in would also bring in very special bottles. Definitely can't afford it now at all. But I got very good at doing it.
No, but it's nice. I feel like a bit ridiculous sometimes when you see the price of the wine, which at the end is just a bottle of 75 centiliters of wine. Yeah. When you say like it can cost, as we talked before, like the GRC can be up to 20K for a bottle. I mean,
it's unbelievable.
It's kind of, it's just wine at the end, you know, it's just supposed to be something you share with someone you like and having a good time. And now it costs like two cars, brand new.
I was very lucky to get invited to the 2014 On Premier tasting it for DRC.
Mm.
My boss couldn't go, so he was like, would you like to take my ticket? And I was like,
yeah,
I'd like to. And I remember I was so nervous. I was literally shaking. And I was there and I was like so conscious of what I was tasting. I was like wanting to make bright loads of notes. And I was just like was thinking about it just too much. And I ended up meeting Aubert de Verlaine and he started speaking to me in French and I'm very sorry, but my French is not very good. And then I also was like mixture of like nerves and the fact I couldn't speak French meant that I didn't have a very good conversation with him and he can speak very good English as well. So that was a bit of a shame.
Yeah.
But it was very special.
That's nice.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, Alex, for
today.
Thank
you so much.
And again, guys, if you want to have that discount, check the link or otherwise just put Breaking the Cork 20 in the discount code in the checkout.
See you next week.
Take care.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you so much. The Hospitality Podcast.